Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Shanitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Understanding and Managing Chemotherapy Side Effects. And this is a very important call, one that many of you have requested that we offer, would like us to offer it more often than we do, actually. And it's so important, and we have really quite a team of experts to kind of go over some of the issues with you and give you some really very helpful and practical tips. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach so many of you on the call today. We have on the call today over 961 participants, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions and states in this country, and we also have international participants from Argentina, Canada, China, Egypt, England, India, Korea, South Africa, Syria, the United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and really it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Today, this activity is supported by an educational donation provided by Amgen, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program. Now, I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations. Now, there is also an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. We very much rely upon your feedback to let us know the programs that you want us to do that would be helpful to you. So we take quite seriously your recommendations. And so tell us what you want, and we'll try very hard to implement your recommendations. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, really quite an extraordinary group. And I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Lydia Shapira. Dr. Shapira is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Staff Oncologist, Gillette Center for Breast Oncology, Massachusetts General Hospital. And Dr. Shapira is going to cover a number of treatment side effects, causes of chemotherapy side effects, managing nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation, practical tips to deal with fatigue and infection control, recommendations to deal with hair loss, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn this program over to Dr. Shapira.
Well, thank you very much. It is really an honor to be with all of you, and I hope that in a small number of minutes I can cover a whole lot of content. Let's get started then, and let me start by telling you that not all chemotherapy drugs are created equal, and that means that they work slightly differently, and they also may be associated with slightly different side effects. Most of the chemotherapy drugs affect cells that divide very quickly, so their main targets are really cancer cells, of course, but some of the collateral damage occurs with cells that line the gastrointestinal tract from mouth all the way down to the anus, the blood cells, so there may be side effects such as low red blood cell counts, which cause anemia, and sometimes that translates into fatigue, low white blood cell counts, which increases your vulnerability to an infection, and sometimes even low platelet counts, which increases the vulnerability to bleeding and bruising easily. It also affects the hair cells and causes a very distressing side effect of hair loss. Chemotherapy often is associated first and foremost with nausea and vomiting, and I'll tell you that decades ago when I first started, the vomiting was really one of the side effects that was most awful to bear and often led patients even to have to receive their treatment in hospitals. We have come a very long way from that time, and now we have wonderful combinations of medications which actually work by slightly different mechanisms. And one of the advances that I celebrate greatly, and I know my patients appreciate, is that by sometimes matching certain drugs to the particular chemotherapy. So by matching anti-nausea or anti-emetic drugs and combining them in certain recipes or cocktails, we can actually stay ahead of the nausea and vomiting and prevent it altogether. So it's possible actually to manage these side effects so well that they're almost not there. So as you think about or anticipate getting chemotherapy, perhaps one of the first things to think about is that understanding the particular side effect profile of the drugs that you receive may help you come up with a plan with the help of your team, your nurses, your physicians, pharmacists, whoever else is involved, that anticipates the most likely side effects and gives you a bit of a roadmap and some medications to use to prevent them altogether. We unfortunately are not at the point where we can prevent the hair loss, but we are quite good now at preventing the nausea and vomiting, and we're also pretty good at helping to restore the blood count sometimes sooner with the help of medications that stimulate your own bone marrow to work overtime, sort of puts it on overdrive. So with nausea and vomiting, perhaps my advice is to try to stay ahead of it, sometimes getting the medications round the clock for the first couple of days after receiving chemotherapy can prevent that from happening. And then using a few other medications on subsequent days, perhaps the third, fourth, fifth, sixth day, may also help with that queasiness that is left over. Every person is different. Some people just throw up at the sight or the mention of the word chemotherapy, and that is because there is a component of that of sort of anticipating the nausea and just thinking about it may make you sick or queasy. And other people are much better adapted at handling it, and that has nothing to do with how hard one tries. It perhaps has much more to do with how one is hardwired. Some people have motion sickness and others just don't. So this is an important and crucial side effect and one that can be handled and can be personalized so that the experience is more bearable. I've had patients over the years who just need to come in to get some fluids intravenously on the second or third day after getting chemotherapy. And if that's the case, it's better to do it than to fall behind and then become dizzy or very weak. It's really important to stay ahead of the fluid requirements to flush the chemotherapy drugs out of the system and also to feel well. Fatigue is a bit harder to deal with. Fatigue can be caused by so many different things, ranging from the drugs themselves to some of the anti-nausea medicines that you take that can make you a bit sleepy, to lowering of blood counts and to just feeling blah, which is such a common experience of patients who have chemotherapy. One of the tips I can give you for dealing with that is to try to pace yourself and manage your energy, perhaps having small, frequent meals that are rich in protein, perhaps taking a nap at some point during the day, perhaps really organizing yourself so that you know when you need to be at your peak performance, and then build in some rest times during the day. Another bothersome side effect, of course, is the hair loss. And, of course, there's the body image piece, which is especially hard for women. And I've seen many strong women cry over this. But it's also the fact that the scalp is easily irritated and may actually hurt you even before the hair falls out. Now, the hair loss is usually quite predictable with some drugs, and we sometimes can tell patients exactly when it's going to happen so that they can be ready. And sometimes it's not as predictable, and that depends on the drug. Some drugs cause more thinning, and the hair may become coarser and drier, and some drugs just cause massive hair loss. Many patients prefer to shave their head, in anticipation of the hair loss, in a way that allows them to have more control and may be psychologically helpful. In some ways, it's just less messy. Another common side effect of chemotherapy, of course, is lack of energy in addition to the fatigue, and sometimes actually problems with sleep itself. So if you can't get a good night's sleep, you're actually more fatigued. Some of the drugs that we are using can actually interfere with sleep. So again, that's something that needs to be discussed with a healthcare team, because if you can imagine not feeling so well physically and on top of it not having that restorative sleep at the end of the day, it may make managing life a little bit more complicated. We're seeing even some new side effects emerge as we're moving to more targeted therapies, in particular certain skin rashes and so on. So as we have newer and better treatments for cancer, we actually are also finding that sometimes we're learning with our patients that there may be new side effects to deal with as well, and all of these require very careful attention. Back to the GI tract for a moment, diarrhea and constipation are also quite common, and sometimes these are caused by the disease or the chemotherapy, and sometimes caused actually by the anti-nausea medicines. Some of the anti-nausea medicines we use cause terrible constipation, and I know that's a real problem. And again, here the message I have for you is to know the drugs and know your body and ask for help to your nurses and your doctors and come up with a combination both of drugs that help the bowels move well and on schedule, sometimes by adding fiber, sometimes by using drugs that actually control the amount of bowel movements. It's very hard to give one general recommendation, but the point is that almost everybody is affected by this very, very common and distressing side effects. So it's hard to think about how to maintain a great quality of life when you lose your hair, your appetite goes, you don't get enough sleep, your skin doesn't look so good, and you're just feeling less energetic. So I think that here the best advice I can give is, again, to try to plan, to try to have some control. Usually when you start a new treatment, the first time that you receive the medications is a bit of a learning experience, and then you can adjust the kind of medications that you need depending on how you've experienced this particular combination. It depends also on how strong you are. If you're entering into the treatment feeling really well, you may be better able to bear some of these side effects and may need less help. So quality of life, I think of, you know, as evolving over many different dimensions, being able to keep up with your routines, being able to stay and productive. Often that means keeping a job at the same time or maintaining a very important role in family life, or just, you know, keeping your sense of humor, which may be hard to do if you look in the mirror and you sort of don't like what you see or you're not really feeling very well. So as a general concept, I would say that chemotherapy has a whole bunch of side effects that affect our bodies, affect the way we think. Sometimes we feel more sluggish. I hear that from patients all the time, that they're just not as sharp, that they don't remember everything as well. It affects one's sense of well-being. It affects one's ability perhaps to carry on a normal social life. So for each person, perhaps the secret is to know the drugs as well as possible, to have a plan and perhaps even a backup plan for dealing with side effects, to understand what medications can be used to help treat some of the most common side effects, with the understanding that each person reacts slightly differently, and then to quickly make adjustments based on how it actually feels in that moment. So I think I'm going to stop right there and allow the next speaker to go on, and then I'll be very happy to take questions at the end.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shapiro, for just a very excellent and very comprehensive and informative presentation with lots of wonderful information covering such a broad spectrum of a chemotherapy experience, and thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Douglas Peterson, and Dr. Peterson is Professor of Oral Medicine, Chair, Program in Head and Neck Cancer and Oral Oncology, NIAG Comprehensive Cancer Center, University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Peterson is going to address guidelines for dental care during chemotherapy, managing mouth sores and dry mouth, and communicating with your healthcare team. Dr. Peterson?
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It's my pleasure to be part of our discussion today as well. In the next few minutes, what I'd like to begin talking about is the relationship of the mouth and chemotherapy and how we can really prevent many problems that used to occur in patients receiving chemotherapy. I'd like to introduce the concept that, first of all, very importantly, not all chemotherapy causes mouth problems, either during or after the cancer therapy. If there are mouth problems caused by chemotherapy, they typically begin a few days after the chemotherapy starts, and they last approximately 2 to 3 weeks after the chemotherapy ends. So the mouth problems don't typically start the day of the chemotherapy, but rather a few days later, and then they do typically resolve a few weeks after the chemotherapy ends. Now, having said this, given the complexity of some of the mouth complications, including mouth sores and infection, it is very important to have a comprehensive management approach with your healthcare team. And one aspect of that management approach is having a thorough dental checkup and, where necessary, selected dental treatment before the chemotherapy starts, even a few days in some cases before the chemotherapy starts. That can be very helpful in setting the stage for a very positive chemotherapy experience. So absolutely key to this is communication. The patient with the healthcare team, the physician, the nurse, the dietitian, the dental team, even before the chemotherapy begins. And I'm going to revisit this importance of communication in just a few minutes. Now, as far as taking care of your mouth before and during chemotherapy, a very important goal to work to achieve with your cancer team is achieving excellent health of your teeth and your gums and the lining tissues of your mouth. This is always an important goal, and it's particularly important if you're getting ready to start chemotherapy. Now, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, not all mouth disease needs to be treated before chemotherapy begins. For example, if you have the dental checkup and there's a very small cavity or a cosmetic procedure, those procedures can typically wait for many weeks or even several months until the chemotherapy is finished. But if the dentist finds more advanced problems, for example, deep cavities in your teeth, which are a type of infection, or severe gum disease, which is also a type of infection, there are ways that those infections can be eliminated before the chemotherapy starts so that they don't cause problems during the chemotherapy. And really the best model here is to have that dental checkup, work with your dentist, who in turn works with the rest of the cancer team. This can go a long way to preventing many of these problems. As far as some of the problems that occur during the chemotherapy, I've already mentioned that one type of problem begins a few days after the chemotherapy starts, and that's called mouth sores, or mucositis is the technical name. And certain types of chemotherapy can cause a sore mouth. Now, there are a number of products that can help you before and during the sore mouth experience. For example, just keeping your mouth clean and moist with salt water rinses 4 to 6 times a day, and then just rinsing for a minute and spitting it out, just helps keep the tissues clean. If the mouth becomes sore, there are pain medications which we can apply right to the sore area. We can help you with that. Or if the pain is a little more advanced, then there's more powerful pain medications that can be given by pill or injection. And then if there is an infection that occurs because the mouth sore is taking place, the cancer team will work very carefully to keep checking for that infection, and if it does occur, develop a very customized, effective treatment to eliminate that infection during the chemotherapy. Now, Dr. Shapiro has also mentioned some of the new cancer treatments that are coming on board, the so-called molecularly targeted agents. Those, too, are causing a type of mouth sore that can be readily managed by the approaches we've just talked about. The other good news is that there is one drug called Palifermin that is approved in the United States by the Food and Drug Administration for some patients who have blood cancers and who are undergoing stem cell transplant and receiving chemotherapy. Palifermin can be very effective in these patients in reducing the mouth sores. Other drugs are in development to prevent or reduce the mouth sores, and hopefully they'll become clinically available too. Now, as far as the dry mouth component, dry mouth can occur during the chemotherapy experience. The dry mouth can cause difficulties in how food tastes and chewing and swallowing and speaking. It can also increase the risk of infection. However, another piece of good news here is that chemotherapy itself does not typically cause dryness of the mouth. However, there are other medications that you may be receiving while you're undergoing the chemotherapy treatment. Dr. Shapira mentioned some of the drugs to control the nausea and vomiting. Some of those and other drugs can cause dryness. So therefore, if we know which drugs you're going to be receiving for nausea and vomiting, for example, there are very simple treatments for dry mouth. For example, sipping water or sugarless drinks often, avoiding drinks with caffeine, since caffeine can dry the mouth. Don't use tobacco or alcohol, that can also dry the mouth, and avoiding spicy or salty foods, which may irritate the mouth. So just briefly, as I begin to conclude, it's very important to communicate with your healthcare team. You can ask the cancer team if there are any short-term or less likely any long-term effects on the mouth that the chemotherapy may cause, and based on those answers, a very customized approach before and during the chemotherapy can be put in place to minimize any of these mouth problems. And so I remind all of us that not all cancer patients develop mouth problems during chemotherapy. This communication of you with your cancer team is very important. Many of these mouth problems caused by chemotherapy can be prevented. And there are excellent resources for patients and their families and to the cancer team to guide the decision-making and treatments for the mouth. And some of these resources include Cancer Care, really an outstanding organization with outstanding resources. And this partnership, this collaboration, can in turn often lead to important, very positive outcomes for your cancer treatment. Carolyn, I'll stop there and look forward to the rest of the discussion.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Peterson, for, again, just a very outstanding presentation and so much information in terms of care of mouth and teeth and gums during treatment. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Nessa Coyle. And Dr. Coyle is the Pain and Palliative Care Service, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Coyle is going to address really what is neuropathy, describing neuropathy to your healthcare team, and tips to cope with neuropathy. Dr. Coyle?
Thank you, Carolyn, and I'm also very glad to take part in this discussion, particularly representing nursing. Painful neuropathies, can be extremely debilitating for an individual. It can really interfere with quality of life. And the neuropathies associated with cancer and its treatment are caused by damage or irritation to peripheral nerves, usually from one of three causes, either surgery, for example, a mastectomy, a lumpectomy, a lymph node dissection, or perhaps a thoracotomy, and certain neurotoxic chemotherapeutic agents, for example, vincristine and vinblastine, paclitaxel, some of the cisplatin, carboplatin, and oxaplatin, for example, and there are other ones too. And then radiation therapy, though that is less common. When someone develops a sensory neuropathy, often the sensations they experience, they describe that the sensations they're not familiar with. It can be numbness, electrical shock type sensation, tingling, burning sensation, throbbing, itching. It can be also be like a deep, dull, bone-like ache, and sometimes cold intolerance. The other thing that people can complain of is that a sensation which is normally not painful, for example, if you just stroke your arm, does evoke pain in this situation. Also, if such a sensation is just mildly painful, again, this painful response can be exaggerated in some cases of peripheral neuropathy. I'm going to talk a little bit about chemotherapy-induced polyneuropathy. So usually it's called polyneuropathy because multiple nerves are involved because the drug goes throughout the body. And again, often you see that these different sensations that I described, the burning, the numbness, for example, the tingling sensation, the sensitivity to cold, occur in the feet and also in the hands. And that's why this is sometimes called a stocking glove distribution. The symptoms are usually on both sides of the body, and sometimes they're temporary and gradually diminish as the chemotherapy treatment comes to an end. At other times, they persist and require ongoing management. There are certain things that make people more vulnerable to developing neuropathies from chemotherapy. The older person, the intensity of a single dose that's given, multiple doses or cumulative dose, if a combination of agents are used which are neurotoxic to nerves, and if someone has pre-existing neuropathies, for example, like a diabetic neuropathy. Other factors, alcohol use can also contribute to neuropathy. Don't assume that a physician, your physician or nurse knows that you're having these strange sensations and you're developing neuropathy unless you tell them about it. So any unusual sensation that you're having once you start a chemotherapy regimen, it's very important to let your doctor or nurse know. It's particularly important because if they become severe, they can really, again, interfere with quality of life. And chemotherapy regimens may need to be adjusted, but also the symptom itself needs to be treated. It's also very important to have the right diagnosis because not all neuropathies are caused by cancer or its treatment. So don't assume if you're having chemotherapy that a neuropathy is to be expected and self-medicate with around-the-clock, with across-the-counter drugs. Neuropathies that are not always associated with cancer or its treatment, for example, are shingles, herpes zoster. We spoke about diabetes, perhaps atherosclerosis, excessive alcohol use, and sometimes, for example, vitamin B deficiency, especially B12. And in some instances, trauma can cause neuropathies. You'll find that when you start a chemotherapy treatment, usually you'll be asked a series of questions about pre-existing pain and about neuropathy. And this particularly happens prior to starting a chemotherapeutic agent that can be toxic to the nerves. And also after such treatment, a chemotherapy treatment, which may be toxic to the nerves, is started. So there'll be this ongoing assessment. Remember that the expert on the pain is the person who is experiencing it. So your doctors and nurses are not expert on your experience. They can have familiarity with it because of what they've been told by other patients, but you're the expert on the quality of the pain, sharp shooting, electric shock, burning, numb sensation. You also know, will be able to say what makes it better or worse, if it's continuous or if it just comes and goes, and if there are other symptoms that happen with the pain and how much it's interfering with your quality of life. For example, are you able to button and unbutton your blouse? Can you put on your shoes and tie laces? Things like that. So you're the expert on the severity of the pain and how it impacts on your quality of life. And your doctors and nurses, that team, are the experts in sorting out the probable cause of the pain. There are a variety of ways of managing this pain, although it can be difficult for some people. It can be managed, so it's really important because poorly managed pain can really make people quite despondent. So it can be approached, it can be managed, not necessarily all of it go away, but we should be able to keep it under control. The group of drugs that we use are the antidepressants like amitriptyline, nortriptyline, Cymbalta are just some examples. We sometimes also use anticonvulsants, and examples of that would be gabapentin and or Neurontin or pregabalin or is another drug within that category. Sometimes we use steroids if the pain is very acute and severe as a temporary measure. And we also sometimes use the opioid drugs. So we will use, depending on the cause of the pain and the severity of the pain, we can use a combination of those drugs. We can also use some topical treatments like capsaicin and also emla-treme. And sometimes we use a topical lidocaine patch, which can be helpful for some people. Other things that approaches that are really important are not drug-related, for example, biofeedback, relaxation therapy, sometimes meditation and guided imagery. For some people, acupuncture can be helpful, and also transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. But very, very importantly, and I underline this several times, is physical therapy and occupational therapy. That can be enormously important. The things also to remember is that make sure that you're not taking anything that can be toxic to the nerves at the same time as you're receiving chemotherapy. So, for example, alcohol, perhaps just one or two drinks, can be toxic to nerves and may make the neuropathic pain worse. And if you're a diabetic, for example, it's really important that blood sugars are kept under control because sugar is also toxic to the nerves. Importantly, keep ahead of the pain. So if you have chronic neuropathic pain, you'll be prescribed medication on an around-the-clock basis. So take it around the clock. Don't take it when the pain is worse and stop it when it's feeling better. That's really important. You need to keep ahead of the pain. And again, sometimes, as I said, we use these several classes of medication to control the pain. So it's almost like someone once told me, like being a great cook, getting the right combination together for a particular person. Other things that are really important, particularly if you have numbness in the feet, you really need to, again, be very careful. Look at your feet, look underneath your feet. Sometimes people use a mirror to do that. If your hands feel clumsy, again, occupational therapy can be enormously helpful in giving you assistive devices with larger grips. Sometimes with a physical therapy, there can be stretching of the heel tendons. Otherwise, if they're tight, you get more pain on walking. If people have a lot of difficulty and numbness in their fingers and yet their work entails using computers, then sometimes they use a voice-activated computer. Stress mats in the kitchens can be helpful. Very important, proper footwear. Sometimes orthotics can be helpful put into the shoes. But again, physical therapy and occupational therapy are incredibly important and should be any part of a chronic neuropathic pain management. I think I'll stop here, Carolyn, and pass the phone back to you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Quill, for just a very almost encyclopedic review of neuropathy. I think you really covered a very comprehensive review, and I know there'll be questions for you about neuropathy during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Our next speaker is Maria Petzl. Maria is a dietitian. She's senior clinical dietitian, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Maria is going to actually address with all of you nutritional concerns and tips that might be helpful to all of you. I turn the program over to Maria.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be a part of the call today. And thank you all for joining and taking time out of your day. Quickly, our goals of nutrition are to maintain dose and schedule of cancer treatments and to play a role in the management of these symptoms. I'm going to touch briefly on mouth sores, poor appetite, nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea and constipation, but there's so much information available. You can contact Cancer Care to get some additional information, and also there's a great booklet called the Eating Hints Booklet that's available from the National Cancer Institute that can give some tips on additional chemotherapy or treatment-related side effects. Dr. Peterson gave a great review of some of the nutrition tips for mouth sores and dry mouth, and I just wanted to add to those. With mouth sores, some of the things that can be helpful are to avoid foods that can irritate the mouth, like foods that are citrus-based or have a citrus marinade, fruit juices, foods that are acidic, that are tomato-based or pickled. That would be foods that are made with vinegar. Also, foods that are excessively spicy or salty, and rough and coarse foods can irritate mouth sores. Foods that are at temperature extremes, especially hot temperatures, can cause more pain in the mouth, and therefore eating foods at room temperature can be helpful. for dry mouth, using extra gravies, sauces, taking sips of liquids as one is chewing and swallowing to help really moisturize the food in the mouth. And with both mouth sores and dry mouth, avoiding alcohol, as this can dry the mouth and irritate the sores. For poor appetite, one of the things I really stress is actually planning meals, sitting down the day before and planning out the times of the day and planning out what is scheduled, what you plan to eat the next day. Certainly, when it comes time for lunch the next day, if you've planned to eat a sandwich and fruit and you are more interested in eating pasta with chicken breast, then you should eat what you're hungry for. But having a plan the day before can eliminate some of that mealtime stress that can go on when you're trying to think about what your appetite is for. Using liquid supplements or smoothies between meals as a way to stay on the go, be up and about, but still get good nutrition and fluids in. With nausea and vomiting, I cannot stress enough how important the medication is to help with nausea and vomiting. There are nutrition tips, and there are things that you can do to complement this, but absolutely being aggressive with anti-nausea medication is very, very helpful. From a nutrition perspective, really eliminating offending odors. This may be that family members would cook with windows open and fans blowing to get some of those cooking odors out of the house, or using more room temperature and cold foods. After periods of rest, when there hasn't really been anything on the stomach, using dry crackers or dry toast to kind of help soak up some of those extra liquids in the stomach before going ahead and eating a full meal. Avoiding foods that are overly sweet, avoiding greasy or fried foods or foods that are highly spiced, as these can cause more nausea, may sit in the stomach longer and cause more discomfort. And then also really eliminating stress at meal times, making it a nice, peaceful, comfortable environment. For bowel management, it's really important to work closely with your medical team. There could be multiple causes of diarrhea, treatment-related, cancer-related. Also, something such as bacterial overgrowth or lactose intolerance could play a role. Regardless of what the cause of diarrhea, when somebody is having diarrhea, some nutrition tips include avoiding lactose. So even if somebody is not lactose intolerant, during times when they are having frequent stools, they may actually have more diarrhea when consuming lactose-containing foods. An alternative to avoiding lactose-containing foods would be to add lactase enzyme. A brand name for this is Lactaid, but this is the enzyme that helps digest that naturally containing sugared lactose in dairy products. Avoiding foods that are high in insoluble fiber. Insoluble fiber creates, draws more water into the gut and can actually create more loose stools. Sources of insoluble fiber include things like bran cereals, brown rice, anything with the whole grain. Beans are very high in insoluble fiber. So during periods of diarrhea, these would be foods to eat less of. Foods that are very sugary or that are sweetened with sugar alcohols can cause more diarrhea as well. So limiting highly sugared foods and limiting foods that contain sugar alcohols as an ingredient. But things that you can do that you can increase in the diet and that you can do to help create a more formed bowel movement are to consume foods that are higher in soluble fiber. Soluble fiber works like a gel. It helps trap the extra fluid that's in the GI tract. Foods that are high in soluble fiber include bananas, the greener the better, the inside of the apple, so applesauce is great, or apple without the peel, citrus fruits without a lot of membrane. So when you're removing the peel and removing the membrane, you're reducing that other kind of fiber that we want to eat less of when we're having diarrhea, but you're getting the good soluble fiber. Also, oats are a great source of soluble fiber as well. It's very important to drink plenty of fluids. If someone is having more than four bowel movements a day, I typically recommend that you get more electrolyte-containing fluids, such as children's electrolyte drinks. A brand name is Pedialyte, or half-strength sports drinks, so something like Gatorade, half-strength, so half water, half Gatorade, or Powerade, half water, half Powerade. And finally, some people like to include more probiotic or more of the good bacteria-containing foods. So the most common probiotic food that we all think about is yogurt. And this is the good bacteria that helps with digestion and helps maintain normal bowel movements. This is also in fermented soy products like tempeh or miso. And this is available in supplement form. This is something to talk with your medical team about if these would be appropriate to include in your regimen. On the other side of things is constipation. And again, medication is very helpful for maintaining bowel regularity. Staying adequately hydrated is very important for bowel regularity. When somebody is getting adequate fluids, you can gradually increase the sources of fiber in their diet to help prevent constipation. And also hot liquids can help stimulate the GI tract. Prune juice is another good tip for helping to manage or prevent constipation. But certainly, in many cases, it is important to use medications to help prevent constipation, as diet may not address it alone. In general, I would recommend that patients eat small, frequent meals. They plan their meals and snacks the day before, get plenty of fluids, choose nutrient-dense foods, foods that are high in protein and good, healthy, nutrient-dense calories, and also to be physically active. This can help combat fatigue, help combat constipation, and help increase appetite. I'm going to go ahead and hand it back over to Carolyn now, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Maria. Just a very comprehensive presentation, lots of information, very informative. And now we have time for questions. And I'm going to ask Geneva to bring all of our speakers on board to open all the speaker lines and also to let the audience explain to the audience how to queue up for questions. We'll try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get your question, you know you can call Cancer Care at 1-800-813-HOPE, and I'll repeat that number throughout the call so you actually will be able to feel like, oh, if I didn't get to ask my question today or have another question tomorrow, that you can always contact us, so please understand that. But we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and Trinta, could you explain how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or if you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question is from Crystal T. Your question, please.
Hi, this question is for Dr. Peterson. And I was wondering, if a patient experiences lots of pain when they're brushing their teeth, is there any mouth care, such as mouth rinses, that can temporarily take the place of toothbrushing?
One question, Dr. Peterson?
Thank you. There are a number of reasons pain may occur during brushing of the teeth. It could be the tooth itself or several teeth, or it could be the gums. And so it's important to discuss with the dentist why the pain is occurring. And there are a number of questions like, how long does it last? What's the type of pain? Is anything making it better? Anything making it worse? Sometimes, although we don't see it very often, but sometimes certain types of chemotherapy can cause tooth pain, even though there's no cavity or there's no gum disease. So again, if it's during chemotherapy, then a good checkup, discussion with the physician, the nurse, and the dentist would be very helpful. There are solutions that can be used in place of brushing and flossing, but the most important piece is find out why the pain is occurring.
Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Carol C. Your question, please.
I have several things I was wondering about. You mentioned shingles earlier. My husband has multiple myeloma, and I have heard that they are susceptible to shingles. However, when I ask about being inoculated myself, I was told not to because I could infect him with shingles. So I'm wondering how you can handle that. And
that's
also
a good question, Carol. Excellent, yes. Okay, thank you for that question, Carol. Dr. Shapira, could you address that question?
Sure. So certain patients have a weakened immune system. They have a form of immune suppression. Sometimes that's because of the actual disease they have, the cancer they have, and sometimes it's because of the medications. So there are many patients with cancer who are very susceptible to getting shingles. And so the issue of whether or not to be vaccinated depends on the circumstances. If the advice you received is to stay away from it because that could expose your husband to live virus, then I think that's very sound advice. So all of these decisions and recommendations need to be personalized, and they depend on the disease and the state of the immune system.
Excellent. And do you want to explain about the shingles vaccine, why it is?
Well, I'm not an expert in shingles vaccine, but I assume that if it contains some form of virus, that not everybody can handle it, so it may actually not be productive. You have to have a reasonably good immune system to be able to develop or mount a good immune response.
Thank you. Okay. We also have a question from one of our online participants, and that is that someone has mentioned that they've noted a change in their in skin color due to a darker color after chemotherapy for about 10 months. And the question is, what causes the change in skin color? Dr. Shapira, could you address that?
These are such great questions. I don't have the very precise, fabulous answers you're looking for, but I will validate the fact that it does happen. There are certain drugs that are notorious for causing what we call hyperpigmentation, which is darkening of the skin. 5-fluorouracil drugs, for instance. In some cases, you actually can see that you can track the veins that the medication went through. So it depends a bit on the person's skin color and the drug. I'm not quite sure why it causes the darkening, frankly. I think it's a fabulous question and one for research, but I will validate the fact that it does happen and happens often.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
This is Nessa, and it's the same topic. Is there skin that there's hyperpigmentation of? Is it skin that's usually exposed to sun, or can it be skin that's covered?
So I think that when my answer referred to all skin, that there can be a certain darkening of skin as a result of drugs, but you bring up a very good question. Point, which is slightly different, which is that some medications also are photosensitizers, meaning that exposure to those medications then makes you burn more easily in the sun, in the very same way as certain antibiotics make you burn in the sun. So I think there are two separate issues. One is that sometimes as a result of the direct action of the medicine, the skin may get darker. And the other is that you need to know and certainly ask as we're going into summer if the particular chemotherapy drug that you're on will make you more likely to burn in the sun. Similarly, for patients who've received radiation to a particular kind of the body, particular type of the body or area of the body, those areas that receive the radiation are more susceptible to burning in the sun. So it's really important to wear sun protection to keep the area covered and avoid direct exposure to sunlight during peak times.
Excellent. These are really, and that's so important because we are, it's true, we are entering, I believe today is the first day of summer. So I think I'm in the U.S., and so I think that we really definitely, that's something to be very much aware of.
Except for our caller in Argentina, who is entering winter.
That's right. So we have all different, zones of weather. So we definitely do have different time zones. And just to be aware of that, though, it's really important. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Janice W. Your question, please.
Yes, I have multiple myeloma, and I've had two rounds of chemotherapy with Velcade, resulting in neuropathy. and I have not had pain, but I have a great deal of trouble with numbness in my feet.
Right.
That affects my gait and my feeling of being secure when I walk.
Right.
And I also have had central autonomic neuropathy when I was on thalidomide. So I'd like to know what I could do for that. I don't have pain. I tried acupuncture, which really didn't make any difference. So that's my question.
You bring up a very important point that not all neuropathies are painful. And you can also get autonomic neuropathies, so that some people can have problems with indeed increased constipation or incontinence, and sometimes motor neuropathy with some weakness. Physical therapy and occupational therapy would be extremely important to you because of this unsteady gait, perhaps, and not being quite sure where you're putting your feet or where your legs are going unless you look down. So that's extremely important that you have physical therapy and occupational therapy. Some of the numbness, again, can also, some people describe that numbness as being painful. And it might be worthwhile, again, seeing whether or not some of those co-analgesics, like the anti-convulsants, might be of some help with that. But the most important aspect is in actual fact, I think, the physical therapy and occupational therapy. Those will help or can help enormously with both your safety and your feeling of security.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Our next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is from Patricia W. Your question, please.
Yes. I'm sorry, I was caught off guard there for a minute. I am on Zometa maintenance, and I've been going for over 2 years. And I really need to have dental work done. I have extractions that need to be done. They've just informed me they want to keep me on the Zometa because of the bone damage. But is it possible to go off temporarily to get some of this dental work done? And how long would I need to be off to do the extractions?
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask Dr. Peterson to address your question in a general way, and then, of course, we very much advise you then to go back to your treating healthcare team. But I think if Dr. Peterson would say something about this and just a general information.
Yes, thank you, Patricia. Very important question. Most of the evidence suggests that taking a patient off Zometa, even for a few months, before oral surgery, for example, dental extractions or gum surgery, is not effective. In other words, taking what we call a drug holiday from Zometa, even for a few months, will not reduce the incidence, the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw. So therefore, the literature says stay on the Zometa, but work with your dental and medical team to really understand why it's important to stay on the Zometa. And with very careful dental procedures and very careful follow-up, the risk of osteonecrosis can be very, very low. And I think that's a very important point to realize, that there's much more benefit to keeping a patient on these bone-modifying agents to protect the bone and the skeleton, and a much lower risk of developing osteonecrosis of the jaw. So it really is a benefit versus low-risk discussion with your healthcare team. And Carolyn's exactly right, because each of these cases is unique and important. It is something to be discussed with your dental team and your oncology team to make sure that the right information is in place so that everyone understands how to manage the dental extractions and how to manage the follow-up. That's the communication that's so important that we were talking about earlier today.
And I'm going to ask thank you very much, Dr. Peterson. I'm going to ask Dr. Shapiro. We actually have, we have actually a healthcare team right here in front of you. So I wondered, Dr. Shapiro, I know this is an issue in terms of your working with dentists and how all that, just so that as a model for our audience as well.
Sure. I mean, the problem with Zometa is that it stays in the body for a very long period of time. So I'm not quite sure how long the holiday would really have to be. to reduce the risk, and then how risky that is for the rest of the body that was deriving a benefit. So I think that, as is just mentioned, the wisdom right now is to continue, but to have everybody on the same page, and I think to have dentists and oral surgeons who really are familiar with the effect of this drug and are willing to work in as part of a team. I think that's really the wisdom right now. And again, looking ahead, there may be newer drugs very soon that don't have this side effect that may be helpful in treating the cancer. So hopefully there will be more opportunities and options in the future.
And there is a question, another question from one of our online participants, and that is there anything that can be done to minimize the impact of the chemotherapy drugs on liver, kidney, other organ systems? And I wonder if Dr. Shapiro could, and that's a very general question,
yeah.
So just if any.
I mean, that's such a brilliant question. How can we sort of protect ourselves from the collateral damage is really what you're asking. And I don't know of any way that you can protect the kidneys other than through intensive hydration. For instance, there are some drugs that in high doses we know affect the kidneys, and so we give a lot of intravenous fluid before and after, and we tell our patients they must drink a certain amount for the first 24 or 20 or 48 hours to sort of flush it out of the system. Other than that, I don't know of any other specific ways to protect the kidneys. In some cases, we actually have to modify the dose and reduce it if there's any sign of kidney impairment even before administering the drug. And with the liver, I think it's a matter of trying to reduce the work the liver has to do, perhaps, and so look very carefully at the list of medications that a patient is on. So if there are other drugs that are going to be metabolized by the liver, we may want to reduce them or omit them altogether. And that's where diet and even all of the vitamins and other substances that people take in order to help stimulate their immune system, or perhaps thinking that they might be beneficial, might also need to be avoided during the days that we're asking the liver to get rid of the insulting agent known as the chemotherapy. And along those lines, it's also important to limit exposures to substances like alcohol for the same reason, because the alcohol is temporarily going to overwhelm the liver. So if we're asking the liver to get rid of alcohol, high doses of vitamins, plus the chemotherapy, it may just be overwhelmed. So I think that in these situations, there is no drug that I can tell you protects the organ, but very careful managing of all of the other substances that are ingested or competing medications may actually minimize whatever damage the chemotherapy may produce.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been an extraordinary team. A team actually to bring back again for another program, because you've just been extraordinary. And I want to thank all of you who also have participated on the call today and asked such great questions that really enabled our speakers to elaborate further on such important points. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of a one-hour program. And so with that in mind, I do want to remind everyone that, of course, you have sort of endless access to cancer care in our services. Those are free services. And our website is www.cancercare.org. And also you can contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And we do have a staff of 50 master's level trained oncology social workers who are here to answer your questions and your concerns. So if you didn't get to ask your question, please do call us today or in the future. But also we offer a lot of other services as well. We offer practical and financial assistance. We also have a co-payment assistance program. So we want you to take advantage of those programs. They can help extraordinarily with the costs of cancer treatments, of course, and also with transportation for treatment as well, and home care and child care. We also offer an opportunity to talk with one of our staff, to talk with one of our social workers, counseling service, and we offer that for free, and we offer also support groups, both on the telephone and online, depending on your particular preference. We have lots of booklets and fact sheets, and, of course, we do many of these workshops as well, these Cancer Care Connect workshops. But most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support, and Cancer Care is simply a telephone call away or a web click away, and a mouse click away, and you can access our staff really quite quickly, and we are here to help you, and to help you both with our services or to direct you to other services that might be of help to you. So I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. That concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.